DBHDD is reminding Georgians to ask their doctor about alternatives to opioid pain medication. Alternatives such as over-the-counter medications and physical therapy can be used to manage pain. More information at opioidresponse.info.
Thanks for listening to the Political Rewind podcast. Be sure to like and follow us and rate us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. I have got to say that I have been looking forward to hearing from the panel we've assembled for today's show as I ask them about major political stories in the news. And so I want to get right to them and begin our conversation. It's Friday, which means my partner is Jim Galloway, the former political columnist for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. Now, in the midst of working on a book, which I'm sure will become a nationwide bestseller the day it's released, Mr. Galloway.
Yeah, probably not. I'm just kind of excited to be here today. I'm just wondering whether I'm going to get charged tuition, you know, with these people talking.
Yeah, we have a great group of political science professors. Jim, I assume you're not talking about the subject of your book openly at this point. Is that what I should take from the way you just... Okay.
Not yet. Let's say Georgia politics will be a topic.
All right. That sounds great. Thank you for that. Well, somebody who has enormous experience in writing books about politics is with us today, Professor Charles Bullock of the University of Georgia. Chuck, I've lost count. How many books have you published related to politics, much of it in Georgia and the South?
It's almost up to 40.
Okay. Well, and you too are working on a new book that perhaps you're not ready to talk about the subject of.
Well, yeah, it's about two-stage elections. So the traditional runoff, the instant runoff, top two voting in California, jungle primaries in Louisiana. So those things.
Okay. Well, we're glad that you're taking time to be with us today. And we're certainly glad to have from Emory University, political science professor Andra Gillespie, who, of course, is also the director of the James Weldon Johnson Institute for the Study of Race and Difference. Hi, Andra. How are you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm terrific. Speaking of books, it's the last book that I think I'm aware of that you published was on the impact of President Obama's presidency in a variety of areas related to how he dealt with race. Fair enough way of describing
yes.
it?
Correct. Called Race
All right.
in the Obama
Well, thank you. Thanks for joining us. And your colleague now, Professor Emeritus of Political Science, Professor Alan Abramowitz. And Alan, as long as we're talking about books, you have written a number of books yourself. And one of the books that really became part of the political vocabulary was your book on negative partisanship. Yes?
Well, negative partisanship is something that, you know, I've been interested in for some time. And I think over the last few years, I think what's become sort of part of the vocabulary, people talking about what's been happening, you know, in American politics.
And negative partisanship has only grown as toxicity in our politics has become more and more a part of what we deal with day in and day out. So, okay, we've established we've got a very smart group of people with us today. Alan, very quickly, we're going to very quickly cover a couple of stories that just developed in the last few hours. And you pointed out one of them before the show. The Department of Labor has released jobs. 339,000 new jobs created last month. That's a huge number. The interesting thing is that the job report, from my point of view, doesn't seem to have as much impact on the president sitting in office as perhaps it might have at one point before.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, this was a very strong jobs report. They actually did revise upward the numbers from the previous couple of months as well. So what we've seen, you know, pretty much throughout the Biden administration has been very strong job growth. Of course, we've also had high inflation. And so that's kind of offset some of the positive impact of the strong job growth. In general, I think what we can say is that, you know, the economy doesn't have as strong an influence on public opinion and on elections as it once did. And that's largely a result of increasing partisan polarization and the fact that voters tend to interpret any economic information that they receive through a partisan lens. And therefore, any positive numbers, you know, will just be interpreted according to whether you're a Democrat or Republican. If you're a Democrat, you think that's good news for Biden. He's doing a great job. But if you're a Republican, you're going to say, no, he's not really dealing with inflation. And anything good that's happening is a result of the policies of the previous administration under President Trump.
All right. We're going to watch that and see whether or not this also leads the Fed to raise interest rates once again with a strong jobs report. Mm-hmm. But I want to talk very briefly about the other story that broke overnight. And Jim Galloway, you watched it. The Washington Post reported that Fannie Willis appears to be expanding her investigation into the efforts to overturn the 2020 election. And we're not going to be able to get into a lot of detail because there's a lot to absorb here. But here's the lead of that story. An Atlanta area investigation of alleged election interference by former President Donald Trump and his allies has broadened to include activities in Washington, D.C., and several other states, according to two people with knowledge of the probe, a fresh sign that prosecutors may be building a sprawling case under Georgia's racketeering laws. So, Jim, the basis of this entire report is that Georgia does have very liberal RICO laws, and it appears that Fannie Willis is now looking at ways in which Trump and his allies have looked to other states to see how they pursued their efforts to call the 2020 election a fraud.
Yeah, specifically, she's looking for information out of Simpatico Software Systems and Berkeley Research Group. These were two firms that the Trump campaign paid about $1 million to in the days following the 2020 election to find proof of fraud. And of course, they didn't, and they buried the results. But Willis wants to know what this firm was doing in Georgia and in other states, and that's the kind of the key that tells you that this is going in a racketeering probe direction.
As I said, there's a lot to unpack there, and we'll watch to see what happens in the days ahead as people respond to this report. So we'll talk about it in more detail next week on our shows. But I'd really, with this panel, want to turn to what has been the biggest political news story of the week, and that has been the back and forth, the debate over the compromise that the White House and Speaker Kevin McCarthy were able to put together to raise the debt ceiling. Chuck Bullock, last night, the Senate approved the compromise. I think the vote was 63-36, so it was done in a bipartisan fashion, just as it had been on the House side. President Biden's going to sign it as quickly as possible, and tonight he intends to give a speech to the nation about what happened. So I think what's important now, clearly the possible practical day in and day out consequences of failing to raise the debt ceiling were very substantial for millions of people. But now that it's been resolved, I think it's perfectly reasonable to turn to see what the political outcomes are. Let me start with you, Chuck Bullock. Talk about how you see this having played out, the benefits to President Biden, the benefits to Speaker McCarthy, how it affected the far right of the Republican Party in Congress, whatever you want to bring to the table, and I want to get everybody involved in that conversation.
Well, as Winston Churchill once said, the United States will always do the right thing, but only after they try everything else. And that's what we've gotten to here. Yeah, we do see, the majorities in the House and the Senate, opposite parties, but they did at least get this done. I was a bit surprised that the margin of the House, excuse me, the Senate was lower than the margin of the House, because usually we think of the Senate as being the adults in the room. And yet here you had 36 senators vote against it, where in the House it was more like a 3-1 margin, which it got passed. You know, four or five Georgians voted against it. And interestingly, it was a bipartisan group of Georgians who voted against it. So several very conservative Republicans voted against it because it didn't cut the budget enough. And then the representative of the 5th District in Atlanta voted against it because she was concerned that it did cut some programs too much. And I think it was primarily that job requirement that's being attached to folks who are between 50 and 54 who are getting food stamps. So you could look at this and say, yeah, this was a good compromise, and that the people at the extremes, you know, both found problems with it. And so we don't think of there being a lot of members of the House or the Senate who as moderates. Nonetheless, what passes for a moderate today did come together, and they got it enacted. So, yeah, and also they've taken this off the table for 2 years. And notice also they didn't set a limit and say, well, it's going up to $33 trillion or $35 trillion. It's kind of no limits. So, you know, it'll go to whatever it goes to over the next couple of years before we have to take another look at this in 2025.
Andra?
So, you know, there are a lot of interesting things that are going to come from this. So politically speaking, they have insulated themselves from having to deal with this again during the rest of President Biden's first term. And this is also, of course, going to coincide with the next set of congressional elections. When this comes up, you know, one of the issues that was raised was whether or not budgets were actually going to be passed in a timely order, or whether or not we're going to have to continue to rely on continuing resolutions in order to propose spending. And so we'll see whether or not that sticks and works going forward, whether or not we're actually going to move back towards something of regular order. You know, and probably moving into the discussion of kind of who wins and who loses, I think there's still a question of whether or not we see somebody on Kevin McCarthy's right flank attempt a motion to vacate because they were truly upset by this. But I think that this shows that, especially with the left and the right being upset by the compromises that were made, that this is a hallmark to the fact that there are compromises where not everybody gets what they want, but most people can find some consensus on, one, we have to do this, and it's important to do this, but then, two, that there's enough in the bill that satisfies everybody. So there are going to be people who are on the polls ideologically who are never going to be satisfied with the compromises that were made, and they're always going to be bitter about this bill, but everybody else in what was a big middle were able to find something that was important, if only that, you know, we didn't want to default on our debt.
Alan?
This is something very unusual in American politics in recent years, and that was a coalition of the center, you know, of Democrats and Republicans coming together, and the opposition being found primarily on the far right. Within the Republican Party, that was the biggest source of opposition, and then somewhat on the far left of the Democratic Party. I think, however, we shouldn't overinterpret this, and we shouldn't assume that this is something that's likely to happen very often. I think it's very unlikely to happen very often. And let's not forget that what it took to make this happen was basically the sword of Damocles hanging over the Congress and the dire threat that was posed by a potential default. And without that, you know, I think it's very unlikely that something like this would have happened. So Biden's clearly a big winner in this. I mean, really, he got most of the things that he wanted from this. He was, you know, the cuts that were put in place really did not undermine his major legislative achievements and programs. McCarthy, I think, solidifies his position within the Republican caucus. And I actually think it's unlikely that there will be an attempt to remove him as speaker based on this. I mean, I think what we saw is that the Freedom Caucus is, you know, they yelled and screamed and jumped up and down, made a lot of noise. And in the end, they had very little influence on the rest of their colleagues who just went ahead and did what they thought was necessary. So I think the Freedom Caucus's influence here within the Republican Party has been somewhat diminished as a result of this vote.
Yeah, Bill, to Alan's point, I mean, we need to note that Marjorie Taylor Greene was voted to approve this deal. She was at McCarthy's side. But I'd like to focus a little bit on President Joe Biden, because this is he has not really kind of spiked the football, if you will, yet. I think that's coming tonight, and I'll be interested in seeing how he does that. But Andre, you wrote the book on Obama, who had to deal with this situation. How would you compare how Biden handled this debt ceiling crisis with how Obama did?
So the question that I was interested in my book is how African-Americans interpreted his policy behaviors, whether or not they wanted more than what they got, and also how they interpreted congressional opposition. And so it would be really hard to disentangle kind of the racial element of this when you're asking African-Americans what they thought. And African-Americans did think that some of the opposition was actually racially motivated. You know, one of the things that is going to be interesting is that standoff in 2011 or 2013 was, you know, then led to a downgrading of our credit rating. And this is something that one of my friends at Christina Greer, now at Fordham University, had looked at the municipal level. And so it becomes a question of, does this standoff then lead to, you know, Moody's downgrading our credit rating, right? Because they see some instability and they just see a lack of consensus here in doing that. And so what Greer argued was that this is more likely to happen with a Black executive than with a white executive because of the racial animus that might sort of promote the cooperation. I think in this context, we're focused on the partisan polarity, and we're not focused on the racial polarity, obviously, because President Biden is not, isn't Black. And so, like, I think that that's kind of the difference in terms of sort of thinking about this. But they both were operating in periods of, you know, really bad partisan polarization that brought us to this level of brinksmanship. It's just that there may have been another undercurrent there based on the identity of the person who was sitting in the office.
Thank you for that. Chuck, let's pick up on what Jim Galloway is talking about, that the president, through the process, never once spiked the football when he thought he'd won some gains. Peter Baker, I thought, had a really terrific piece in the New York Times today dealing with that and the larger issue of how the compromise was made. But here's from the Baker article. He starts by quoting Biden himself. Biden saying to reporters, why would Biden, referring to himself, say what a good deal it is before the vote? You think that's going to help me get it passed? No, that's why you guys, meaning the media, don't bargain very well. The president calculated that the more he bragged that the deal was a good one for his side, the more he would inflame Republicans on the other side, jeopardizing the chances of pushing the agreement through the narrowly divided House. His reticence stood in striking contrast to his negotiating partner, Speaker Kevin McCarthy, who has been running all over the Capitol asserting that the deal was a historic victory for fiscal conservatives. Interesting in terms of his of Biden, who he considers a fairly shrewd negotiator after all his years in the Senate. But also on the other side of that, Kevin McCarthy, Chuck, had more of a reason to need to triumph, to trumpet his successes than Biden did, since he had to try to win over those far-right Republicans.
Yeah, what McCarthy had to do is to convince enough Republicans that indeed he had gotten enough carved out of the budget. Biden doesn't score any points by saying, no, 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 they didn't touch anything. Indeed, what he does is risk the alienation of the critical share of Republicans he's got to have, both in the House and the Senate. Just remember, we haven't mentioned this yet, but, you know, you needed 60 votes in the Senate. 51 wasn't going to do it, where if you could get 218 in the House, you were home free. So, you know, gloating on Biden's part would not score any points. Kevin McCarthy's gloating, did it turn off some of the more liberal Democrats in the House? Probably not. You know, they were probably already turned off. And also, again, you had this huge margin in the House, so you could see Nkema Williams walk away from this and not endanger the enactment, where if you alienated just a few, say, liberal Democratic senators and the Republican, more conservative senators on the Senate side, yeah, it might not have gotten to the 60 votes, or they might have passed, conceivably, some of the 11 amendments were offered. And if that happened, then you had to send this back to the House, and you then you probably run out of time. So yeah, Biden just wanted to kind of step back and hope this thing goes through.
Yeah. You know, Andre, I want to bring you and Alan back in. Let me add a couple of quick elements here. Number one, Jim pointed out that Marjorie Taylor Greene very shrewdly stuck with Speaker McCarthy. He is the guy who gives her power that she's never had before. But just to show you how quickly you can get out of favor with the far right, Steve Bannon on his podcast the other night called for a true MAGA Republican to challenge Marjorie Taylor Greene for in the primary in the 14th district. So we'll see how long that sort of thing lasts. But go ahead and make your point about all this.
I mean, I somehow suspect that Greene is going to be able to withstand a primary challenge from her right flank, if only because it would be hard to find somebody who is more right than she is. You know, in terms of just trying to think about, and Chuck mentioned this in terms of who has the kind of liberty and who has the buffer to be able to do something that looks a little counterintuitive. Nikema Williams has the buffer to do it in part because, you know, the bipartisan coalition of those in the House who are going to support this was going to be big, right? She also has the buffer within her district that even moderates in her district are probably not going to notice or be flummoxed by this particular move that she made. And she's sitting in John Lewis's seat. So she's, of course, going to stand up for marginalized people and stand up for people who are oppressed. This symbolically fits what she's going to do. And for Marjorie Taylor Greene, for those who are surprised that she's done this, she also, you know, supported Kevin McCarthy against the rest of the Freedom Caucus, right? Because it was probably personally and professionally beneficial to her. And, you know, I'm still struck by Patricia Murphy's column when she spent the day with her and Marjorie Taylor Greene didn't act like she was on Newsmax all the time, right? So I think we have to give Greene credit for the fact that she does code switch and knows how to pivot depending on the context that she's in. But I think it's also important to keep in mind that in terms of one, her loyalty to the Republican Party is still very much intact. And it's highlighted and evidenced by this particular vote. So, you know, I went back and looked at her DW nominate scores. We were talking about Chuck's late colleague Keith Poole and the measure that he and Howard Rosenthal used to try to look at sort of ideological polarity, which is really about party line voting. And Rich McCormick is actually sort of like the most loyal Republican sort of party line voter in Congress right now. But Marjorie Taylor Greene is sort of like, you know, in the top 10 or 15 people of folks who consistently vote with the Republican Party line. So, you know, as much as she looks like a maverick and as for all the attention that she gets, she's a loyal soldier. And so because it's personally beneficial to her to support Kevin McCarthy, it's not surprising that she would back him on this bill that he and his lieutenants negotiated.
Alan, before I bring you back in, let's just Alan, let me just amplify something Andre said and make it more clear to our listeners. Chuck initially said that one of our Democratic members of the delegation had voted against it. That was Nikema Williams in the 5th District. And as Andre points out, she said she cast her vote against the deal because of the added requirement of work in exchange for food stamps for people in the age 50 and I think to 54 bracket. But go ahead, Alan.
Yeah, in general, the opposition within the Democratic Party to this, both in the House and Senate, came from the far left. There are only a handful of Democratic senators who voted against this. One of them was Bernie Sanders. You know, but I think when you look at the votes against in the Senate especially, I think it's pretty clear that a lot of those were cast knowing full well that this was going to pass easily. And so there was really no risk that these votes were going to affect the outcome. What kind of interesting to me is that in addition to the opposition that we saw coming from the far right within the Republican Party, we also saw, like, I think, like every leading Republican presidential candidate opposed the compromise. Trump came out against it. Trump actually came out and said he should have, you know, the Republicans made a mistake here. They should have just let us default. So that's just default, you know, as if somehow that would have been a responsible thing to do. But he's not the only one. I mean, DeSantis, you know, went along with that. Mike Pence said it was a bad deal. You know, Republicans should oppose it. You know, so I think when you look at the Republican presidential candidates that what they're thinking about right now is what is the message that's going to appeal to the Republican base? What's the message that's going to appeal to Republican primary voters? And I think when you look at Republican primary voters, it's probably standing up, opposing this is probably something that may actually help you in a Republican primary.
Before we take a break, Chuck, I want to go back to this question of winners and losers, if we think there were any. And I want to pick up on President Biden, because nothing the president has been able to do in his first term, except for the very early days, has done anything to notch up his approval ratings. He continues to be way underwater. And as we just talked about at the top of the show, these terrific job reports that we've seen sporadically during his administration certainly haven't helped his approval rating. The question here is perhaps the same. He guided through a piece of legislation that protects a lot of what Democrats cared about in the face of, for a while, what was really harsh Republican efforts to overturn what he had done. The question is, at what point will he get credit, if ever, for this?
I'm not sure he ever will. I think what we see here is that Republicans, beginning with Donald Trump back in 2019, maybe, has very effectively defined Joe Biden as being a bumbler, as being not competent, as not having the mental facility anymore. And every now and then he demonstrates some physical problems, like his stumble yesterday. So, yeah, I just don't think that Biden is ever going to be seen as being competent, kind of on top of the game, ready to do another term. So Republicans have done this very, very effective job of defining him. And that's interesting in that Biden had been on the scene for 50 years. Now, we often talk about when there's a new candidate comes on the stage, if the opposition can define that candidate before the candidate can define themselves, then that's usually a winning strategy. Biden served as vice president, all these things, and yet still Republicans are able to define him in such negative fashion.
Andra, before we get to a break, one last comment.
Sure. I mean, the bumbling frame had been out for a while. And so, certain things have happened that have reinforced that. I think, Biden's biggest problem is that he ran on competence. And I think what people heard when he said competence and change was, I'm going to do this and I'm going to make it look easy. And the problem is that this is hard and he couldn't make it look easy. And we saw how the sausage was made and we didn't want to see that. And he's being penalized for that, and in some questions, I think we have to ask ourselves whether or not we're actually being fair in our assessment in that particular way.
All right, before we get to the break, and I know we're late, Natalie Mendenhall, but give us a couple minutes here. Jim, as an example of the ability that Republicans have to paint Biden in the worst possible light, Nancy Mace, the Republican from South Carolina, sent out a message on social media when they first saw the compromise, the whole House saw the compromise that had been achieved. She wrote out, and I'm not quoting her exactly, but essentially what she said is, the president can't even find his pants, and yet he whipped us in this bargaining that's taken place. That's an example of what Chuck and Andra are talking about.
Yeah, and it's one instance where Biden kind of overcomes the frame that's been placed around him. I would just add to what Biden gets out of this is this was an act of preservation for Biden. The Democrats did not win actually anything. They did not gain anything, but they were able to preserve a couple of Biden's very, very important initiatives. And that is to say the tuition repayment program that he's got that's now before the courts and his infrastructure bill. Republicans sought to take it apart. He stopped that.
And Alan, again, last word before we get to the break. The thing that got the most, anger from progressive Democrats was adding this work requirement for a certain number of people over age 50. But even at that, at the same time, the compromise expanded the availability of food stamps for a large group of people as well, veterans, the homeless, and others.
Exactly. And I think if you go back just a few days, what you saw was a lot of criticism of Biden and the way he was handling these negotiations by Democrats who were unhappy. They were talking about how the Republicans were winning the messaging war. In the end, I think Biden comes out of this looking very good. shows that he is, in fact, a very skilled negotiator. Whether it helps him politically remains to be seen. But losing on this, I think, would have harmed him politically.
All right. Thank you for a terrific conversation about what's been happening on the biggest news story of the week in Washington. Now we're going to get to that first break of the show. Back with more in just a moment.
Thanks for listening to Political Rewind. If you like this show, you'll also like Georgia Today. It's a daily podcast from GPB News, bringing you compelling stories and in-depth reporting that you won't hear anywhere else. Join me, Peter Biello, for this quick and convenient way to get the best of GPB News' extensive coverage of the topics that matter to you, delivered directly to your device every weekday afternoon.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Jim Galloway, Alan Abramowitz, Charles Bullock, and Andra Gillespie join us for the show today. Let's talk presidential politics. The Republican candidates who are vying for the Republican nomination for the White House. Jim Galloway, the conventional wisdom has been for quite some time now that the best way for Donald Trump to be defeated is if there's a very narrow field of Republican opponents. And that harkens back, of course, to 2016, when one by one, he picked off that enormous field of Republicans, starting with Jeb Bush, who went into that race as the leading candidate by far in most of the polling. So Republicans talked about, we got to keep the field small. Well, Jim, that isn't happening. It at least nine candidates, you know, are jumping into this thing. Next week, Chris Christie, Mike Pence, and the great North Dakota governor, Doug Burgum, jumping into the race. And that's not the end of it. There will be more to follow, we think. Jim?
Yeah, watch this guy Burgum. He could be trouble for Trump. It is, in many senses, in one sense, a replay of 2016, because the way that Trump can dominate a stage is just unparalleled, I think, in modern politics. It is not always a happy thing to watch, but nonetheless, it's something that grabs audiences. It grabs the GOP base. Now the question is, for me, do his troubles, which could start compounding very, very quickly. I mean, the Fulton County investigation, the D.C. investigation into the January 6th incident, his troubles in Manhattan. Do they start to give fodder to candidates who are actually willing to attack him in a much more aggressive manner than happened in 2016? Now, if you remember, I mean, basically the attacks of 2016 were kind of half-hearted. I remember the one that stands out for me is Marco Rubio, who was in Georgia campaigning, and of course he made light of the size of Donald Trump's hands. As something that spoke to Trump's manliness. Trump fired back, and the senator from Florida just quietly silenced himself. But if you're going to take down Donald Trump this time, I think you have to, once you wade into that fight, I think it's something that you cannot stop. And that's one reason why I'm more interested in seeing what Chris Christie does, the new former New Jersey governor, than what Mike Pence does.
Yeah, Chuck, I think Jim would say that because Chris Christie has shown no hesitation to attack Donald Trump. He's done it for some time after being a firm ally of Trump's earlier on in the Trump administration. But the question, I guess, given that Ron DeSantis so far has been the closest contender to Trump in the field, although most polls show a pretty big gap between them, is it DeSantis who has to be the first guy to really start taking on Trump more aggressively? He's kind of moved in that direction, but what are the perils of continuing that further?
Let me begin with an ancient analogy from Georgia, which no one will remember. But Gene Talmadge, a four-time elected governor of Georgia, had 100,000 voters who would stick with him through anything. So in that sense, he is analogous to Donald Trump, who's got at least a third, maybe more than that, of the Republican electorate who will stick through him thick and thin. What we're seeing in polling here in Georgia is that, yeah, most Republicans here would say they would vote for him once again. So he's got this firmly committed base. So what happens? Well, again, if we try to take a lesson from 2016, in those early primaries, Trump was getting a third of the vote, but he gets 62% of the delegates. In South Carolina, he gets a third of the vote, but some of the Republican primaries, winner take all. So he gets all of their delegates. On Super Tuesday, he wins 7 of 11 states. Highest share of the vote he gets anywhere is 40%. He exceeds that in two states, and this is a strange combination. It's Alabama and Massachusetts, but those are where he does best. And yet, although he breaks 40% in only two states, he gets 43% of all delegates decided then. He doesn't get a majority in the Republican primaries until he gets to what was then his home state of New York. And by that point, it's pretty much all over. So, yeah, what the Trump campaign is counting on is that, yeah, Ron DeSantis is a leading opponent, but, you know, there will be a few percentage points that'll go to Chris Christie. Maybe even this guy from North Dakota may be able to find a few percentage points. And so if indeed the opposition continues to be split, given those kind of Republican rules, especially in the winner-take-all states, Trump can very easily, you know, roll up, get the delegates he needs, and not be even breaking 50%. Now, I think he'll do better this time as a former president he did 8 years ago, but he doesn't necessarily have to win the states with majorities. All he has to do is get that headline that says Trump wins again, no matter how narrow the margin is and how much below 50% it is. So that's why he is so well positioned as this field becomes more crowded.
Andre and then Ellen, jump in.
Rules mattering. And so, you know, here's the rules about winner take all versus proportional representation, which Democrats resolved in the late 80s, right, have consequences in terms of who's able to win elections. You know, we saw like Republicans attempt to try to raise those thresholds after Ron Paul in the 2000s. And all it did was actually make it easier for the primary winner to take more votes. So like these are things that you have to think about in terms of getting into the nitty gritty and the details. I think part of the reason why you see so many people jumping into the field is that they do see the possibility that Trump isn't going to make it, right? Because he's going to be legally embattled and have to pull himself out. And they don't see a resurgent Ron DeSantis yet. And so because they've seen him decline and they don't see him building momentum, they're like, yeah, well, we're not sure that number two is it. So I might as well throw my hat in the ring because I could possibly be plan C and maybe I will be able to get there. And then there are the people who are just running for vanity. So if you look at somebody like a Vivek Ramaswamy, right, like he's not going to be president of the United States. I think he knows that, but he at least gets to sort of, you know, burnish his name ID and that'll translate to something else later. And I think for somebody who might be ambitious like a Doug Burgum, that's the other reason to do this, because he's not Christy Noem, so he's not a household name even in Republican circles. So that's going to, you know, be something that's going to, this is going to be something that's going to make him better known.
Alan?
Yeah, so I think Chuck made the very important point that the Republican rules, and Andre reinforced this as well, strongly favor the front runner because of the numbers of winner-take-all primaries. And the only hope for someone like Ron DeSantis is that he can force out a lot of these other candidates very early on. That if they all do very poorly, you know, in Iowa, New Hampshire, which is still loom large on the Republican side, not on the Democratic side, but Iowa and New Hampshire is still crucial in setting the stage. If, Trump and DeSantis come in 1-2 in those early states and the others are far behind, and then some of those other candidates drop out, and then it comes down to a one-on-one contest between Trump and DeSantis, then maybe DeSantis has a chance. I think that's not very likely, but it's possible. I don't see any other Republican candidate at this point having much of a chance. I don't think Chris Christie is really serious about trying to win the nomination. I think he's in this to go after Trump. I think he just wants to take down Trump. And the other thing is, you know, with all these legal problems that Trump is facing, and he, you know, it's pretty likely that we're going to be looking at additional indictments. you know, coming up this summer in the Georgia case, probably fairly soon in the two federal cases involving, you know, both the documents, which there's just more and more damning evidence that's coming out, you know, every day about that, and then about the insurrection itself, about his role in inciting that. Will that hurt Trump? I say probably not, because what we've seen so far is that it just reinforces the loyalty of his base to him, because they see him as the victim. They see him as, you know, being unfairly attacked by his political enemies, by the establishment, by the deep state. And this is all this. And he'll, you know, I don't see any indication that he would drop out. So maybe, you know, that will change. But I think in all likelihood, if anything, it just strengthens Trump's hand.
Jim, before I get to the final break of the show, I don't remember if it was the Bulwark or some other publication that is conservative but anti-Trump, created a scenario that doesn't seem far-fetched based on what Alan just talked about. It's an image of Trump at a rally sometime early next summer, having been indicted in any number of cases, going on stage at the rally, raising his pant leg to reveal the ankle monitor that he is wearing, and the crowd going wild with enthusiasm. And you know, that sounds incredibly far-fetched, but it really does go to the point that what Trump said 5 years ago or so, he could kill somebody on Fifth Avenue, seems to still possibly be true for his supporters today.
Yeah, I'm going to riff off something that Chuck Bullard said about Gene Talmadge, you know, getting caught up in scandal and then not affecting his base. I think the line, Chuck, wasn't a, yes, I stole, but I stole for you.
Stole for you.
Right. All right. That's a perfect way to end the segment. Look, when we come back, let's talk about how we see this all playing out in our state, Georgia. We'll be right back. Honor Gillespie, the gathering of state Republicans at their convention in Columbus next weekend increasingly is clearly going to be a meeting of MAGA Georgia Republicans. David Schaefer, the chairman of the party who will relinquish that seat in a new election, one of the fake electors. Mike Pence has dropped out. He will not give a speech at the convention. And so they've invited instead Carrie Lake, the failed Republican candidate for governor in Arizona, one of the MAGA-ist of all candidates in that 2022 election cycle. And yet Trump remains incredibly popular here. So here's my question to start off this part of the conversation. What does Brian Kemp do? Presuming that we get closer and closer to a nomination for Donald Trump, and when we watch the Republican primary play out here in Georgia, what does Brian Kemp do? Does he find another candidate? Does he stay out of it? I find that to be a really interesting question about him.
You know, this is something that other states are grappling with. And so we've seen the MAGA wing of the Republican Party take over state and local Republican Party operations in various states. So in some respect, it's not surprising that Carrie Lake is now going to be a keynote speaker at the Georgia Republican Convention. I think the question is that, you know, what we've seen Governor Kemp do is to create a parallel organization, right, based on his experience and based on his connections, that's actually, you know, personally beneficial to him and to his allies. But I think the larger question is, long term, does this end up doing damage to the broad Republican base in Georgia by fracturing it and then letting the most extreme voices actually have official positions within the party? You know, he might be trying to burn itself out. Like, you know, when people see the likes of Carrie Lake or Candace Taylor, right, who's got a local party position, you know, who's espousing, you know, really bizarre things, even more bizarre than she did when she ran for governor. You know, do people see that and then do they recoil, or do these people become entrenched and then actually end up shaping policy and shaping strategy for a generation to come? I think that that's the big deal. I think for himself, he goes the parallel route, but from an institution building standpoint, this should give everybody pause.
Alan?
Well, I'm surprised to hear Andra talking about someone who believes in the flat earth theory as espousing extreme views. referring here to Candace Stewart. I just wanted to make sure that we brought that up at some point. No, Kemp's not going to be there, of course. Kemp is ignoring this. I think his strategy is clearly to try to ignore what's going on within the state party organization as much as possible, and for as long as possible. And eventually, you know, he probably will be forced to endorse the eventual Republican nominee, even if it's Trump. I can't imagine him not doing that. But I think it'll be, you know, he'll try to, you know, minimize his involvement in that for the time being. But this is a real problem for Republicans. I think we've seen this all over the country, as Andra pointed out, that the MAGA, there's a MAGA takeover of the Republican apparatus that's taking place here. And to the extent that it results in the nomination eventually of candidates who are aligned with that wing of the party, I think that's a real threat to the party. And I see Carrie Lake as a rising star in the MAGAverse, you know, and a potential running mate for Donald Trump.
Chuck, Andra talked about if the state party is taken over by the far right. But it's really a matter of when, isn't it? I mean, the delegates that are going to the convention next week, many of them are far right activists in the Republican Party. Candace Taylor, a district chair. What we're referring to is the fact that Candace Taylor, who ran for governor as a Republican, was on a podcast not long ago and affirmed that the earth is flat as a pancake. And she's very upset by, quote, all the globes everywhere there's globes. You see them all the time. It's constant. My children will be like, Mama, globe, 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 globe. That's what they do. They brainwash you. And these are the people who are going to be standouts at the convention next weekend.
And that's why I would say it's not if or when the MAGA group takes over. It's now. They have taken it over. They control the party. And that's why Mike Pence doesn't want to show up, because he knows if he does, he's going to get booed. So that's not a way to, early in stage of your official candidacy, to show up in Georgia, a swing state, and get booed off the stage. So, of course, he doesn't want to come and participate in something like that. So, yeah, Kemp, I think Andra suggested this, he can do well, he can raise money, he can pursue his objectives, but what about other Republicans? They're going to have to, you know, pledge their troth to something, either to whatever Brian is able to set up on his own and hope to get funding out of that, or they're going to be attached to this increasingly far-right Republican Party. And what we've seen in this last election in Georgia is that, yeah, Republicans won every statewide seat except for that of the U.S. Senate. But the Republicans who did best were those who were estranged from Trump. So Brad Raffensperger, percentage of his vote goes up 4%. Brian Kemp up 3%. And the two who do worst are those who are closest to Trump. So, yeah, Warner loses. But then also our lieutenant governor barely wins, and our lieutenant governor is going to the convention and is, you know, very, very close to Trump.
Jim?
Yeah, well, first of all, on what does Brian Kemp do? I mean, Georgia politicians have a fine, fine tradition of going fishing when they disagree with their direction of their party. So I think we might see a little bit of that. But to Chuck's point is yes, this is still the Republican Party. This is still the infrastructure you need to win, and that's why I think yes, people are going to be looking at Carrie Lake, at Donald Trump, and Asa Hutchinson, I think is going to be there as well, presidential wise. But I think the person really to watch at this Republican convention is going to be Burt Jones. Because if a mega controlled party has a future in Georgia, I think he is well positioned himself to be its leader.
So it's going to be fascinating. Is there any? I know I'm pulling this out of thin air, so please tell me if I'm wrong. Is there anything that could allow for us to have competing Republican delegations at the GOP National Convention next summer, if in fact the MAGA forces do control the party apparatus? Chuck, you're the guy with the greatest background on this sort of thing.
Well, Georgia has done that, did it back in 1952.
Yeah.
But I would think the party rules are such now that, no, they wouldn't be able to. But then, hey, you know, they cobbled together a different set of presidential electors. So I guess it doesn't mean you couldn't send someone. And maybe because Georgia did not jump on this opportunity Democrats offered to move the selection process forward, it may be pretty much all over by the time Georgia votes. And so that, you know, whatever comes out of the presidential primary in Georgia may not be that meaningful. And so maybe you could cobble together an alternative set of delegates and claim that they have some legitimacy.
Wouldn't that be fun for all of us to get to talk about? I'm afraid we're completely out of time for today's show, but what a great way for us to end the week on Political Rewind. So Professors Charles Bullock, Andra Gillespie, and Alan Abramowitz, thank you so much for a terrific discussion today. Jim Galloway, of course, always glad to have you as my partner on these Friday shows. That's it for us. We're back here again on Monday. But in the meantime, I hope everybody out there has a terrific weekend. Let me just say thank you to Victoria Evans Cash, to Buddha, to Chase McGee, and to Natalie Mendenhall for their work behind the scenes. I hope you all have a good weekend, too. I'm Bill Nygut. Take care, stay healthy, and yes, be kind to one another. Bye, everybody.